Miami. Hello and welcome to Dynamite Neddy. It's a retro games podcast where a couple of OW pals get together and talk about a couple of OW games. The voice you're hearing just now is myself, Mick Clockerty. Joining me, as always, we have Mr. Andy Mack.
Konnichiwa.
And Mr. Mick McCormick.
How's it going?
Hey boys, as ever, it feels like a wee while. What he's been up to? He's been playing any decent games, or what's new?
I'll pass it forward to McCormick on this occasion, because we like to go back and forth on these things, and I don't know what I've lost track of the order. So on you go, McCormick.
So we like to go back and forth, but you don't know which is back and which is forth, so you just like nominated me anyway.
Exactly. I'm in fucking Dynamite Neddy limbo, man. I don't know what the fuck's happened.
Flawless logic.
Men without rules.
I'm playing a couple of things. I've started playing that Moon, which you've probably heard of. Another one of these things that's tangentially connected to Undertale, so it's kind of cited as an inspiration for it. It was released in Japan back in the PS1 era, but kind of never got translated in English up until just a couple of years ago. And then they brought it out on the Switch. And then the version I've been playing is on the PS4.
You need to talk to fucking Leo. Leo has been trying to get me to play that for fucking ages.
I figured this would be the sort of thing Leo would be into. It kind of describes itself as like an anti-RPG. I would kind of describe the gameplay more like an adventure game, but the way it starts off is it's your typical kind of like Japanese RPG introduction.
Nay, dad.
I was like a dragon. His like old school RPG, like Nessie. A dragon's taking over the town. The king's asked a hero to come and fucking defeat all the monsters and save the day. So you're playing the start of this game, and it's kind of, it's quite cheesy looking pixel art graphics, like really like broken English translation. And then it does like an abridged version of an RPG. And then you hear, right, son, you've been playing that for too long, man. It's time to go to bed. And the wee guy like turns the console off. But then as he falls asleep, he gets transported into the world of this game. But what he finds out is that the hero, from his perspective, is doing all these heroic things, but like to the perspective of the townsfolk and that, he's just an absolute nuisance. He's just like walking around like fucking attacking the local wildlife, kind of stealing things from people's drawers, stuff like that. Like just an absolute nightmare. He's caused chaos in this place.
I think when that game first came out, that must have been like, oh, this is dead clever. But in kind of this day and age, like, it's kind of well-trodden now to be like, aye, Link for The Legend of Zelda's an arsehole. He's smashing everybody's pots up and that. People kind of see the other side now as well.
Aye, since people started writing web comics about it and stuff like that.
Aye, definitely.
That's kind of the story of the game. It plays out that you have been tasked with kind of like restoring love and kindness to this land. You do that by helping people and by like restoring these monsters, well, so-called monsters that the knights killed, sort of restoring their souls to their bodies. You start gaining these love points, or it's a level-up sort of system, and what that lets you do is it just lets you carry on each day a bit longer. You can kind of like explore a bit further away from your home base without getting knackered, because if you fall asleep and you're not in your house, it's game over. There's adventure game sort of style puzzles, but it progresses in that you're leveling up, and as you level up, you can reach out further and kind of go to new places further along in the map. Weirdly, it reminds me in that sense a wee bit like the Digimon game we played, except a lot better. Like, but there was something about that where it was like your sort of progress was limited by your sort of strength and your ability to like just survive out of your comfort zone for a while. So that gives it a kind of interesting momentum.
And how big your Digimon's shines were.
Jobbies,
I can't really remember other than that it was very scatological.
Aye, there was a lot of jobby. There was jobby in it, definitely jobby in it. There's been jobby in a couple of games. Remember the Mad Eddings, Zero Wing?
I like that Andy kind of cedes the floor to McCormick, is quiet for like 4 minutes, and then is coming in to gaze a history of shite in gaming. This is like peak Neddy. Sorry, Andy, continue.
What a magic mushroom thing last week.
That's right. No, the literary genius that is fucking Zero Wing, man. Fucking, if you go to the lengths that we did to translate the good endings, apparently they're all fucking dousing each other and pushing shit and all that, and they've asked us a space, aren't they? A bit like an interdimensional Red Dwarf or something, I don't know.
Maybe that's what they're going for. I was enjoying it. I've not got super far in it yet. Some of the puzzles seem a wee bit obtuse, or maybe like making more sense to your average Japanese person. But still pretty good. There's some kind of like lovable characters in that. There's a wee NPC that I really like who owns a record shop. When you approach, he's kind of zone. He's like playing a pure rock and solo on the electric guitar. But then if you get close enough, he kind of goes, oh, puts it away, and as if he's embarrassed. I quite like him.
He's a shy genius.
Aye.
Yeah. There's a homeless guy you meet, and I forget what his name is. It's like Humphrey or something, but his first line of dialogue is, "Dang it, I'm Humphrey. I'm a smelly old vagrant. What's your excuse?"
That's a good stoit name for Frankenstein. Humphrey Frankenstein.
Oh, Andy, we didn't record that, but
you kind of get away with Humphrey as a big stoic guy's name, man. As I say, you're talking Davies, Craigs, Rabs, nae fucking Humphreys, man.
Bernie.
I'll give you Bernie.
Bernie Frankenstein.
Bernie Frankenstein. If you're wondering, listener, we were talking about monster names, I suppose, before we started recording, and I was pointing out
This whole thing that pedants say that you shouldn't call the monster Frankenstein.
Aye. Whereas I think you should, because the monster refers to Frankenstein as his da. Therefore, Frankenstein is also his fucking surname. And then we were trying to work out a good name, a good forename for the monster. Hence how we had like Craig Frankenstein, Rab Frankenstein, Bernie Frankenstein. I like it.
See, in a mad semantic philosophical way, this kind of could be linked to our discussion on Knuckles' chaotix, like where the apostrophe is. Is it his chaotix? Does the chaotix belong to him? Or is it like Frankenstein's monster? Where's the apostrophe? I think the position of the apostrophe should be considered first. But I also think that Bernie Frankenstein's a cracking name.
And like Dynamite and Eddie, like is Dynamite an adjective? Like is it like it's pure good? Like it's Dynamite or what? Is it something that actually explodes? Who knows?
Is it? It's a wee guy holding a bottle of water. It looks like Dynamite Eddie. I think that's. If it's not that, then
that's a literalist perspective. Alternative ideas are welcome.
Aye. We're open to interpretation here at Neddy Trivers.
Aye, and if you've got some good stoic big hard man names to put before Frankenstein, please get in touch, because we will be looking for those. Andy, outside of the literary mind of Mary Shelley, have you been looking at any computer games?
Aye, yes I have. Right, I know every time I come here it's Sonic, right? But this is Sonic coming at you from another angle, right? There's a game that I've been playing. It's based on an old Doom port, what is it called, Doom Legacy, port of Doom, and it was changed into this game called Sonic Robo Blast 2, but they've took it even further now, and they've made a cart game out of in a Doom engine.
And I think I've seen this, it looks pretty cool.
They've used fucking Mario Kart as the kind of standard, like the kind of blueprint for what they want to do, and it's fucking brilliant. It controls like Mario Kart, it's less hassle than Mario Kart, it's brilliant, it's water. What a game, man.
Who's your character? Knuckles, I take it.
Aye, how did you guess, man? How did you guess? See, Knuckles isn't as fast, but obviously he's got better handling.
Better control, I would have thought so. I don't know why that makes sense, but it just does.
Aye, he's got better command of the road than that. But a lot of people make their own wee character in that, because it's all about customization. It's open source. So.
Oh, do you get to put like sick furry stuff in it? Are they sexy in that? Can you? You don't get to put them in leather.
I've not seen any of that, to be honest.
Well, I kind of get my OC in it then.
what I've seen is, though, if you get into the online servers, they're fucking packed to the rafters, man. There's cunts that sit on this all day. And you get, like, maybe say the maximum is 16 players in a track. Then you get about maybe 6 or 7 games. They've got, like, 12 to 16 in it.
Oh, it's an online game as well?
Aye, man, it's online. Aye, international popularity. It's got all the fucking, like, accessibility, a Mario Kart. It's obviously not got as good graphics and all that, but it's what it's got Sonic tunes, Sonic levels and all that. It's brilliant. It's really good.
McCormick in a Sonic Kart racer, who are you playing?
Oh, that's a good question, man. I think the first one that comes to mind for me is Shadow. I don't know why. I just imagine him being a good racer.
I didn't even need to think about it, and my answer was Shadow. He's the best.
Heels though.
Well, I think I have to be maybe Shadow dressed up as Blackbeard, and you have to be Shadow, but he's actually green in a dress like Pinhead. Some along those lines, just to differentiate them from each other. Well,
that is our OCs, but I've been playing a wee bit of a fighting game, actually. I think I was saying to you in the chat, I was in that boozer in the town, which is not my favourite pub by any means, the Raven.
Uh-huh, you're saying that's right.
They've got a King of Fighters 2003, but Andy, as you were pointing out, I don't think it's the actual cabinet. I think there's a fucking... I think it's a Neo Geo and the fucking cart or the board or whatever is plugged into it.
You just make a good point with all that. It's like, you would want a Neo Geo, like a proper fucking cab, didn't you? That's a big ask in 2022, isn't it?
If you're an enthusiast, man, if it's not just a novelty in a quirky pub, then if it's one of those, then you might as well just have one of those like emulator things that you can play 500 games on or whatever.
I think it is a Neo Geo. It's not one of the fucking 301 things or whatever.
All right, cool.
If it is a Neo Geo, I'll get in there and I'll fucking buy it. I'll try and buy it off him. I'll be deadly serious with him.
Much.
See, I need this Neo Geo, man. I fucking need it. I don't know, man. I don't know. What's Jenkins sell is it for?
I don't know. I know a couple of guys that could probably bump it for you.
I'll need to get used to gays. I want to carry it.
I've been getting into that. It's one of the fucking... He's no King of Fighters. It's basically like fucking Smash Brothers, but for fucking weird SNK games. And there's like fucking hundreds of characters in it. I've been fucking about playing as a big wrestler guy called Tizoc, who's he's like a sort of half-man, half-eagle. And I usually put him in a team with a couple of like lassies, because I like the lassie characters because they're quicker.
Was it the SNK that did that kind of pioneered that thing where you pick a couple of people and you kind of tag them in and out? Because that sounded like the SNK versus Capcom games and that.
Aye, I think SNK did it first, maybe even in the King of Fighters. Although it's in Marvel versus Street Fighter, but I wonder, was it in Marvel versus SNK first, and was it in that because it was in SNK games first? And it's pretty good. You kind of just, I know in some games you can switch any time, and this one you need to fill a bar up, and then a thing will flash up on the screen and say switch okay, and then you can sort of switch your characters out that way. I've been getting into that. I've been playing it on my Retroid, and I think I'm going to plan a wee excursion to the pub to play it on the stand up way again. But that's me. I've not really been fucking about anything else.
Last man, the whole arcade thing is something that we talk about constantly, and there's not enough of it in Glasgow, man. There's Super Barrio. I had a pure unfortunate, I was pure expecting, walking into G-Force or something. I walked in, and a guy, you walk into sort of Barrio, and there it is, man, fucking Mortal Kombat 2, man, boom, 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 all the tunes are blasting, you're like, you see fucking Shoot a Monkey Ball, the version with the fucking banana controller, by the way, right, not just the pish. You've got the Simpsons 4-player cabinet, right, the likes of which hasn't been seen since the 90s, man, these parts. But the guy isn't very knowledgeable. You know, I went on and on and on about fucking arcade cabs and that. I could see he was being kind of bored, right? He just wanted me to buy me a drink. I says to him, you don't really know much about this, do you? He went, mate, listen, see all this arcade cabinets and that? He's like, this is just a business fucking idea I had. He's like, I've not got any affinity to these things. I just replace these things all the time, that. I was like, oh, well, fair enough, man. This is capitalism, innit? But, you know, if that's people's attitudes to beauty, and monuments of video game past, then I suppose that's why we're probably not going to see much of it anymore.
See, I always prefer when you find a fucking arcade machine, even a fucking Pandora's box, even one of your 201 efforts or whatever, in an unexpected place. And that goes fucking double for pinball tables. See, if I walk into a pub and I see a fucking pinball table, I'm fucking mentally logging that. Like, I need to remember where all the pinball tables are at all times.
You should start a wiki or something and get folk to point out where they are in Glasgow or cities around the country.
There's not so much arcades, but what there is fucking, like, this other thing where you go and play computer games on a console and that, it's just not the same. What you want is a coin-op arcade, man. That's what we're fucking missing. That's what the people want. And when I say the people, I mean the freeers.
Aye.
It's a license to print money, that market.
Aye. Money we've not got.
Well, we're not going to get into a politics corner about the cost of living crisis because it'll take too long. But needless to say, fuck the Tories.
Aye.
No. Are we going to get cracking with our first game of the evening, or have yous got any other business you'd want to air out before we go on?
I went to Alton Towers, that was pretty good.
Oh, we need to hear a bit about this.
the bus.
Was there arcade facilities down there, first of all? Was it mostly puggies, and did they have a Zoltar? And do you know what I mean by a Zoltar?
I don't know what you mean by a Zoltar. It was in Big, wasn't it?
Yes.
In terms of theme parks and that, there's a bit of a gradient from kind of like seedy to professional. Like, I'm thinking in one end you've got like Disneyland, very slick, sort of family-friendly experience that's been like handcrafted to your every want and dream, and also to make a shitload of money off you. In the other end, I'm thinking something like M&D's, right, in Scotland.
A Pleasure Beach, where they sell you
Pleasure
fucking
Beach, exactly.
They sell you plastic bottles of Tisky at every fucking counter.
And Alton Towers is square in the middle of that, right? In one hand, you've got these amazing cutting-edge roller coasters, the Smiler, it's got 14 inversions on it. There was one that had VR in it. It's also got a kind of the fair that comes to Greenock atmosphere to it as well a bit. There's a lot of kind of, like 10p machines. Those arcade machines that you're more likely to find in a kind of adult arcade, the ones that feel like gambling, and a lot of like your kind of carnival game typings, like Hook the Duck, Win a Prize, that sort of patter.
Did they have I think some variants of it's called a Kentucky Derby and others are called like Arabian Nights. You roll a ball up and it makes the horses go along and you've got a commentator trying to take money off you. Did it have one of them?
That's called Arabian Derby and it's got a tune that's amazing.
Aye. Well, Arabian Derby, that's one of the versions of it. The one
McCormick, I don't know if you can find it, man. I don't know if you can find it. It's going to be quite hard. But see if you can find it. Please, can you put any Arabian Derby tune? Racing on the Arabian Derby, so play it now. Throw the ball to get the scores, ride the win and the prize is yours. The racing on the Arabian Derby, so play it now. And McCormick, you judge for yourself if it's too racist to put in, right?
If you're listening to this section, you'll know whether or not I found it too racist. Instead of the tune, I just put in like a land acknowledgement.
Saudi Arabian national anthem instead.
I think they did have one of them. They had the one where you've got to like throw all the things that are like deceptively simple but are actually really hard, like throw a ball into a bucket without it bouncing back out again, which
to win
seems
a teddy
easy
or whatever.
Until you understand that like, conservation and momentum is going to just completely knock it right out again. Things for winning like giant dogs or Pokemon, actually. There was a lot of Pokemon toys you can get and shit like that. But it had a very old school sort of feeling to it, which I quite liked in comparison to the more curated theme parks of the modern day.
I went there for some like thing. It was the day with scouts. Old Jim was there. Jim had worked at a bomb factory. we were on a bus.
Right, hold on. McCormick, cut us out if needs be. Andy, you can tell us as pals, did you get kidnapped?
No. I remember watching Babylon 5 my dad, right? And fucking, he got a phone call saying there's a spare seat on a bus or something. And my dad had me up there within 10 minutes. And that was, I don't know, must have been fucking up to something the next day or something. But I just remember getting a shot of that, what do you call that thing? It kind of keeps you on the edge. It goes, are you ready? And then drops you.
Oh, Oblivion. I went on that twice when I was there the other day.
I was pretty cool at that, man, I've got to admit. But the one I didn't find so cool was the one where at the time it was just out and your legs hang. And it's like a roller coaster, but the roller coaster's above you.
You wear a harness type thing.
Aye. But that was pretty cool, man. It was quite... And it was like blood all around you. It was a bit like Indiana Jonesy. It was like blood, pools of blood.
Oh, that's Nemesis.
Nemesis, that was it.
That one, that was one of the kind of first big hits they had. That one's a wee bit tired now. It's not really as exciting as some of the more modern ones. There's another one which is called Galactus. It used to be called Air, and that's the one where you sit and you hang down, but it rotates you 90 degrees, so your head is like facing forward.
Ah, right.
And that, I only went on that one once because it gave me a sore head. But that's also the one that it had VR components in it at one point in history, but it made folk really ill, so they took it out.
My take on all this is that Alton Towers is just fucking Tory Flamingo Land, innit?
Loudoun Castle for life. gone but not forgotten.
Loudoun Castle, man, that's lying like fucking desolate now, innit?
Folk do urban exploration there and like post pictures of it looking pure post-apocalyptic. It's like the roller coaster's been reclaimed by nature and that.
I think if Loudoun Castle had never existed and you gave Andy Mack, I don't know, like a quarter ounce and a couple of coloured pencils and went like that, design a theme park. Loudoun Castle is what he would have came up with anyway. Like, this is a William Wallace ride and all that.
I never ever went to Loudoun Castle.
He went in his dreams, though.
You would have loved it most of all, man. It was literally fucking Braveheart themed.
Aye.
Anyway, will we get into our first game of the evening?
Yes.
So, as it was in the run-up to Easter, me and Mr. McCormick both found our way towards thinking of sort of religious-themed games, and I thought, what better way to get a bit more Catholicism in the podcast again than to go for Dante Alighieri's Inferno, Fae the Divine Comedy, which is a C64 adaptation, which is fucking really weird, and I found it while deep diving on the internet probably like a year ago, and I thought McCormick would be the one to take a look at that. Mick, how did you get on? Did you find those virtuous pagans you were looking for?
Sadly, that's only like a very short part of the beginning of the game, and you don't even meet any of them. It's just, it's only virtuous in the fact that there's no one trying to kill you. So, right, Dante's Divine Comedy. I'm going to probably talk a lot about the book because I've not got a whole lot to say about the game. So this was an epic poem, I suppose you could call it, written in the 16th century by a fellow called Dante Alighieri. It's considered to be like the first great work of the Italian language, which was kind of like Scots was considered to be a sort of like lesser language than English because it was spoken by commoners. Italian was thought in much the same way because the noble people would be able to speak Latin. But this was kind of the first great work written in Italian. It's part one of three. You've got Inferno, you've got Purgatorio and Paradiso. And that's about the poet, or Dante, who's also the main character. His journeys in hell, purgatory and heaven, respectively. But maybe unsurprisingly, the most popular of those ones is Inferno, because hell is a bit more... just a bit more of an exciting place to set a story than Purgatory in Heaven.
It's the only one worth reading of the three, man. I read Inferno. I'm not the best at reading fucking classics or poetry by any means, but you can sort of zone out a wee bit when you're reading Inferno and just let all the fucking creepy, fucking mad, horrific imagery like capture your imagination. It's not a bad read in that sense.
That means Inferno, is that where all this kind of goblin and fantastical thing comes from?
It's the circles of hell. Is it seven circles of hell? Nine circles of hell?
Seven circles of hell, but like the later ones are kind of subdivided a bit further for like different types of sinners. So the kind of interesting thing about this is that, so the idea of hell is not really, it's not really described in the Bible much, if at all.
It's like very abstract. It's not even in the fucking, Jewish people don't really even have it because it's not really fucking in the Old Testament.
There's references to like a place that souls go after death, but almost everything else that came after that came this, it's like biblical fan fiction almost. It's like people that fill in the gaps, like, well, we never really explained what hell was in the Gospels, so I think it might be like this. There's kind of all sorts of literature from like the Middle Ages of people saying, I went to hell and this is what it was like.
A lot of the type of shit our teachers would have told us in Catholic primary school about hell would have been from things like the fucking Inferno rather than from the fucking New Testament. It's, seriously?
I know, and I'll tell you what, telling a Wayne they're going to hell, man, that's fucking child abuse. I don't care what way you dress up.
Well, they never tell you that, man. It was always that you would go to purgatory, but if you were really, really bad, you would have to wait in purgatory for fucking ages.
You need to be a bleep, McCormick, but see if you went, if you're going to be like, you're going to hell. You're not even going to purgatory. You're going to hell, and you're just going to have infinite chairs slung at you.
Aye, yeah. Catholic school teachers always had that one in the back pocket to scare the bejesus out of you. That's kind of the interesting thing about Dante's Inferno. It's really the main sort of contributing factors to like our modern idea of what hell is. Like a shitload of it comes from Dante's Inferno, the idea of the seven circles of hell, the idea that you would go to like a different bit of hell if you'd committed different sins, and they would be like a kind of ironic punishments, or like fitting punishments for that particular sin. Like that's all over here. But it was never really written as like, oh, this is an extra wee bit of the Bible, like a bit of biblical fiction, and this is what I think hell is like. It was written as like a kind of political satire, almost.
There's political satire in it. Dante was a wee bit bitchy and fucking...
very bitchy.
Hell is full of figures that he didn't like. So like a politician that he might consider a fucking, do you know, like a bit of a fucking beast, a philanderer, it would be like, oh, fucking... And this is the level of hell where there's like all the naked people are there, but demons are fucking stabbing them, and this is where the sin of lust goes. Oh, and look, there's fucking Bishop de Magliazzone. He's fucking here. You know why. Like, it's really just him slagging a lot of people he didn't like for various sins that he saw them as having committed, I suppose.
I always thought that character, Murray, the Monkey Island, was a bit like Dante's Inferno. He's like a character he'd meet in that, isn't he? Like, he'd be like one of the characters, the skull that terrorises Guybrush.
Here, I'll tell you something. I know I don't want to offend any Italian listeners, but Inferno could have used a fucking talking skull, man. Just saying.
It would have lightened things up a wee bit. Yeah, he was like, Dante was involved in politics. He was involved in the kind of like struggle between different factions.
He was a Florentine Republican guy.
Yeah, it was like a kind of political dispute over like whether the Holy Roman Empire should be able to nominate bishops and stuff like that. So like the stuff on the other end of this debate, he would like say, yeah, he's actually in hell because he's the fucking lustful or deceitful or stuff like that. And it's quite like indicative what sins he thinks are like worse than other ones. So like the murderers like are in a kind of lesser circle of hell than like folk that talk shite behind your back.
Well, so
that's the thing he really doesn't like.
Traitors is the worst fucking circle of all.
Aye, when you get to the very end of hell where Satan himself, the great betrayer, he's been punished.
He's got three mouths. The biggest one has got Judas in it. One of the other ones has got Brutus in it for betraying Julius Caesar. I can't remember who the other third fucking traitor is, but the traitors are in the really bad bit.
Aye, yeah, so that's you can tell the sort of people that he really didn't like. But another part of it, and this is also a kind of bit of an interesting effect on like how we view hell, because he takes a lot of it from much older like Greek mythology. So he puts things in like Cerberus, the kind of three-headed dog, Charon,
the ferryman.
The ferryman who kind of like, he's the person that takes Dante from Limbo into the first circle of hell.
I got excited when he was in a C64 game.
His biggest kind of inspiration to becoming like a poet and writing poetry was Virgil, the ancient Greek poet.
Did this not kick off like a Renaissance? That's fucking the poems like this. Like, even like, the art that goes with the Dante's Inferno, like a lot of the art and the kind of mannerisms of the subjects in there they look kind of like Renaissance paintings and, you know, just the way they act and talk and all that. Philosophical stuff.
Yeah, like all the, when them, like, Medici's and that were kicking about, they were funding things like art and science and literature and stuff like that. This would have come out of like, that kind of period in Italy.
It was all based on like Plato and the Republic, no, that, wasn't it?
Yeah, rediscovering sort of Latin works, like Dante did. He rediscovered the works of like the ancient Greek poets like Virgil were becoming popular again, and he considered himself to be really inspired by Virgil in writing this epic poetry.
Because the Roman Empire, when they died and then a fucking Black Death came in, it took a long time for it to kind of bounce back, and this was like when these guys funded all this art, it kind of brought it all back again, didn't it? Philosophy and all that, and
yeah,
humanism.
It's pure wee guy behaviour. Like, imagine fucking, because Virgil is the other main character in the fucking Inferno bits, like, they become best pals and he sort of leads them about a place. Imagine fucking writing a novel where it's like, me and Franz Kafka went up to Glasgow on a night out.
yeah, writing a story about hanging about and being besties with your hero.
Fucking Hemingway or something.
That's basically the plot of the book, is that Dante, he's kind of having a bit of a crisis. He's in the book, he's walking towards this mountain that he associate with paradise. But he can't get up the mountain because there's these three creatures stopping him. And then he bumps into this guy called Virgil, and Virgil says, look, I can take you there, but you have to go through hell first. And kind of Virgil guides him through hell, through all the various circles of hell, seeing what happens there. And then at the end, passes through there onto purgatory. So for some reason, they decided to make a game about this on the Commodore 64.
How do you turn that, as you say, the great work of the Italian language, how do you turn that into a C64 game?
At a time when the kind of the most literary game was something like Zork, where it's like you see a house, you see a hole in the ground, you climbed in the hole, you've been eaten by a grue.
The Hobbit text adventure game or something, for instance, as well. It's interesting that they didn't go for a text adventure and instead went for this weird fucking graphical adventure thing.
I feel like you could probably have gotten a lot more of the substance of the book if you had made something like a text adventure. But what they've decided to do is it's a top-down action game where mainly you're just like dodging enemies, picking up items occasionally and using them. There's kind of maze sections. You're kind of walking through, getting down the further circles of hell and like encountering various monsters.
It is actually quite accurate. You go through them in order as well, or the order that he does in the book.
Yeah, so you go through the circles of hell and encounter a lot of the stuff that Dante did in his journey, but on Dante's journey, like, he wasn't in any danger. Like, he was just being shown around, like, this is what happens to the lustful, this is what happens to the greedy, Virgil saying this and that to them. He has to talk to some people, but he never fights anybody. He never, gets set upon.
You never have to dodge naked people getting blown about in a tornado. Like, run through them like Frogger. Or, like, demons walking about trying to whip you to punish you. You don't have to run away from them.
Aye. So that's the sort of stuff you face. So you've got, like, for example, the bit Mick was talking about. In the poem, it describes the sin of lust. The lust were punished by being...
Oh, Christ. Is that a bit of Marquis de Sade shows up at that point?
Not really, no. It's a bit more chase than that. So I'm reading your kind of cliff notes of the book here, but it says, the lustful were punished by being tossed about by the winds as they were slaves to their desires in life. So what that translates to is, yeah, as Mick said, Frogger. And if you're left to right, you've got to dodge them. And if you hit you, then you get blown about as well. And that's a bit shite.
hell, man. Got a fucking killjoy. Fucking hell. So much for a poetic epic, man. Frogger.
And then you've got, like, gluttony, which is the gluttonous. You can tell that if gluttonous people to be kind of like animals, like living at their base instincts, rolling about in the mud, just focused on the baser things in life. Translate that. In a C64 game, that's just like big horns come up and try and grab you, and you've got to avoid the hands. So, yeah, it's interesting how they've adapted it. This was like all you had in gaming at the time. Like, this was the only sort of forms of expression that you had in gaming at the time.
They used the SID chip to try and emulate some classical music to varying degrees of success, I think it would be maybe fair to say.
Yeah, I mean, the music is... I guess it should be played in a harpsichord. It's the Sid's Chips best impersonation of a harpsichord. It's nothing great. It's no Rob Hubbard levels of greatness.
Man, I tell you, you can't really hold that against them with the hardware they're using, can you? I mean, fuck, I don't know. Is Frogger that bad, man? Frogger's get his philosophical discussion.
Here, I don't know how much mileage McCormick got out of it. See if you played this through perfectly, by the way. If you could just day this without getting hit, or if you put an invincibility cheat on, this game would be about 15 minutes long, maybe.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where it's all about your trial and error, and you kick back to the start if you do anything wrong. I think with save states, I could have maybe progressed a wee bit further, because you would get past like a puzzle, and then you figure out how to do the next one. But completing this game is like just being able to do all of them in order, and some of them can be quite cheap. So yeah, I never get super far in it. My journey through the game was, I got through the limbo with the virtuous pagans, picked up a few items that you use later in your journey.
You've got to pick up a bag of coins to pay the ferryman before a swarm comes and fucking gets you, like locusts or something like that.
Aye, that's what's described in the book as well, that they're tormented by insects, and the only way they can escape the insects is by going like further down into hell, which is a bit of a dilemma, obviously. So yeah, so you get past them, you give the coin to Charon across the river, you get chased by a demon, you pass Minos, the king of Crete, who in the book, he is a sort of judge who would judge what level of hell you should get sent to. But in the game, he just has a big tail that he whips you away.
He's like a dragon.
He's like a big dragon thing. You pass the lustful, like naked bodies flying around in the wind. You dodge Cerberus. It's actually not three. It's not a dog with three heads. It's just three dogs, I think, weirdly. Aye. Cerberus.
Cerberus, the dogs was where I had a save state. I had a lot of trouble.
That bit is quite annoying.
Getting past one dog in particular, who kept going to, like, I had to walk up a path, and I only had a very small margin of error to get past it before it would, like, kill me, and then I would need to start again.
There's a couple of ways you can kind of get around that. If you can outrun him, like, make him follow you a bit, you go a bit faster than him, and then you kind of convince him to go one way, you go the other way.
Aye.
That's how I managed it. That also leads to another thing that I quite liked, is like, taking the source material very literally, again, is that the levels loop on themselves left and right, so I like to think of that as like that they're being literally circles of hell.
Yeah.
Because it's circular. So that was quite good.
I think the presentation's a strong point here, man. You get to some of the circles, you get to the bit where it's all fucking freezing cold. Did you get that far?
I'm not sure. The bit I remember was another kind of part for the book is like the people that committed suicide, had forsaken their body in life, they would forsake their body in hell, and then their body kind of gets twisted into like tree branches.
Yes.
And that's kind of represented in the game as well. You pass through this horrible forest.
It's creepy as fuck.
Graphically, like some of the representations of some of these ideas is quite cool. I passed the Tartarus folk rolling the boulder up the hill, passed the horrible Hauns, I got to Medusa, again from Greek mythology, Medusa freezing me. I couldn't figure out how to get past her, to be honest, and that was about it.
You need to kind of walk around in circles. There's this weird pattern that you have to walk in that makes her like look at you and then not look at you.
Right.
Did you find any of those cross items that just kill all the demons on the screen?
Yeah, that's the only sort of weapon you have, I guess. Mostly you're just running away for these things. But if you pick up the Lord's Cross, then you can use that as a kind of smart bomb.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
But if you use it in the wrong place, you just die later. So.
I mean, I just find the whole thing quite baffling, to be honest. Like,
that's what makes it good.
Yeah, that's what it definitely makes it interesting. It's like,
did you see the ending screen?
I don't think so. No, I was watching a playthrough on YouTube just to see what happens at the very end. But do you not just get to see like the devil and then you go up to him and that's game over?
And you get the final circle. Satan's there, the big man himself, right? And you walk up to him and then. I think it says congratulations.
Does it tell you it's on these one?
No, you see a cross, and then it plays like a Sid Chip version of Joy to the World. And then it just goes back to the start of the game.
Amazing. So we were kind of talking about this, like I think I was thinking like, you know, is this the sort of work that you could adapt to a game given like 30 more years of experience? Like you were saying that you would have almost liked it if there was no challenge. It was just walking about. Let's see, like a walking simulator of hell.
I was thinking that if it was a walking simulator and they animated all the different bits of hell, especially with this kind of primitive graphical style.
Yume Nikki.
I enjoy that about it. Kind of like Yume Nikki. But as we've been talking tonight and we've been describing the lustful circle of hell as Frogger, I'm like, no, it should... Don't change a fucking thing. It should stay the way it is.
I like Frogger. I like Frogger. See, just like... You don't play it for any length of time. Right, but see just for that wee blast, man. See if it's a well done Frogger. You get good Frogger, well done Frogger, and you get shite Frogger. You get a good Frogger, it's pretty cool.
Dante Alighieri dodging naked bodies getting whipped about the wind for their sins.
That's
good
is Frogger.
Good Frogger.
That's
aye.
Good Frogger.
is this a level 2 of flashback again? Lustful circle of hell. I think I would have just liked it better if they put all the obscure Italian political commentary in it. I would like to be chased down and eaten by that dog, and then a wee screen appear and saying, this dog is actually Pope Gregory the IV.
Yeah, or if at the start, before you actually go into hell, you got to walk about and talk to virtuous pagans. You don't need to put that much in, lads. Just say, all right, I'm Aristotle. And then maybe a wee bit, use it as a teaching moment.
Aye, like in a Assassin's Creed, it's time.
Speaking of which, this is a better adaptation of Dante's Inferno than that one that came out on Xbox.
Right, so I've not played this, and I don't know if I could put myself through it, but their adaptation is, yeah, even stupider, really, than this one. It's like, what if Dante was a cool knight? And he fought loads of demons on
He's fighting in the Crusades, and then oofed. the creatures of hell. Yeah, the creatures of hell steal Beatrice, and then he has to go in and save her. And he's like a big buff guy that, you know. And this he is a writer. He's a fucking wimp. Anything can kill him. and that in itself is far more honest.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, judging it against that, you could say it's quite an accurate portrayal of what happens in the books, but judging it against literally anything else, then maybe not.
It's always fucking religion, isn't it? It's always religion, man. See if you took religion out, let's carry on. What do you think Dante's Inferno would be like without religion?
I thought this way once, right, when I was going through my fucking edgy Richard Dawkins phase, right, but... Religion, even if it's nonsense, like it or not, like the amount it is contributed to like our mythology, our like, you know, it's inspired people to create a lot of great works of art. So much of our culture, even like so much of our like the tons of phrases we use come from the Bible and stuff like that.
It's
like,
mythology is important, man. It's Joseph Campbell shit.
Dante's Inferno is a great work of art, whether or not you believe in Christianity or not, and if Christianity wasn't a thing, then we would have never got it.
I suppose, aye. All the artists channeled all their best work through the lens of religion, wasn't it? Because that was a big thing. The public consciousness was religion. There was no telly of that, was there?
And the subversive ones did it, but they hid their fucking subversive shit in, like, fucking double entendres and fucking, you know, like, painting certain things that you couldn't really work out, but... you know what?
Masons.
Actually, there's that rat's Pope Gregory. You can tell because that's a lot. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely, like in this period as well. Like that was like the height of this kind of pattern, the Enlightenment, and it was kind of like these a lot of these kind of great works of art and music and literature and everything were being funded by these kind of great patrons. But the way you would kind of show off like how wealthy and powerful you are is like you would commission. Like Leonardo da Vinci to paint you a picture or a scene for the Bible or something. It wouldn't just be like, oh, paint me a picture of like, I don't know, fucking Luke Skywalker fighting Darth Vader. Like the only kind of cultural reference point they had was the Bible at that time.
You know, religion, what, it never becomes cliche. Like, when do you ever hear somebody going, oh, this again, about like fucking resurrection or Christ, you know what I mean? But if it's done like, on a... It's done like in the context of Star Wars or something, or for fuck's sake, here we go again. Empire versus a fucking Rebels.
I mean, they all do follow the same sort of fucking hero's journey pattern. all these things. And in some cases, they just literally do Christianity again, like fucking the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe type. When Aslan showed up, I did say it all this again.
In the West, like in kind of Christendom, it's impossible to get away from like the influence of the kind of Bible stories that they've been like, reflected in even our modern pop culture, just because like they're so ingrained. Like these resurrection type stories are like, we keep kind of telling like the similar themes over and over again.
Well, I mean, E.T. himself is a Christ-like figure.
Yeah. I mean, the works of Steven Spielberg, you can probably classify a lot of them as like a biblical allegory.
E.T. probably looks closer to real Christ than the fucking American version.
not sure if that's racist.
No, that could be in fact shit.
That also comes for the Renaissance period, which is a kind of favourite story of Mick's.
Yeah, I don't know if we've got time to go into this because we have been on our Italian Renaissance poetry section for a wee while now. But if you Google the conspiracy theory about our depiction, particularly, I don't really know about Protestant depictions of Jesus because they don't have him up on the wall the way we do. But if you've ever been to chapel and you look up and you see Jesus, the basis for him is apparently Pope Alexander the 16th's son, Cesare Borgia.
Ah, you told me this before. Yep.
I think he was vaguely kicking about round about Dante's time, or maybe just a bit after it, when Da Vinci and Machiavelli and that were about as well. There is a conspiracy theory that the basis for our fucking likeness of Jesus is this guy, Cesare Borgia. And also some people who go deeper into that and say that he was the Antichrist. it's pretty cool.
I think the first part I can get behind. He was a bit of a bad bastard, though. Dante's Inferno on C64, I wouldn't recommend it, to be honest. I don't think it's a very enjoyable game. Interesting, weird culture artifact, but I don't really think you gain much by playing it, more so than you would by watching it on YouTube, and it's only 5 minutes from start to finish.
I wouldn't recommend it if you're a baby, but if like me, you're an enlightened scholar, I would take a look. You can play it on a browser, just saying.
I mean, if you're an enlightened scholar, you're going to read the book.
Now here, there's a Galaxy Brain meme here where the bottom panel is playing the book as Frogger.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I would recommend listening to the audiobook while playing Frogger. I think that's where you would get like a superior experience to playing this.
Fair play, that is a true bottom panel.
Let's leave it there.
That brings us nicely on to our next game, which is Faxinado. Can we iron this out, actually, before we even kick off? How do yous fucking say the name of this game?
I struggle, man, because I know that the second part is Xanadu. I should say I know that because of the famous poem, but I know it because of the Rush album.
It's supposed to be Xanadu because it's a portmanteau, a Famicom and Xanadu, but in my head I just read it as Faxinado.
See, I was born with great ignorance in my heart, and I just read it as I see it. So I just say Faxinado.
Faxinado, that'll do.
It rolls off the tongue. Doesn't make a lot of sense, but it does roll off the tongue.
Right. Andy, why did you pick, and I mean, I don't know if this could even have anything to do with the band Radiohead, but you might surprise me here. Why did you pick Faxinado for myself?
Numerous reasons. Obviously, you had like that Axe Battler game for the last episode, uh-huh. And that sparked a wee thought in my mind. I remember you going, I didn't like this because it was a bit too, perhaps, basic, in a way. And I thought to myself, I remember this game, it was like a bit like Zelda 2, in a way, and it was called Faxinado. And the reason why it kept coming up over and over again is I'm a big fan, as you know, of the band Radiohead, and they sampled this game's music like 4 or 5 times. So in various interviews, Johnny Greenwood, the guitarist, he always talks about how much he loves this game and all that. Talks about like he says that the personalities in it are brilliant and all that stuff. And it's in quite a few of their songs. And I thought to myself, fuck, aye, I'll game make this because this is the type of game kinda. And maybe we'll get a good write up about it, or maybe it'll just be complete shite, and it'll just be proof that I'll listen to any old shite that Radiohead does.
Well. First of all, Faxinado is getting a special Dynamite Neddy Award.
Best ladder.
How ironic are we going here?
Faxanadu is getting the Dynamite Neddy Golden Snout Award because this is the only Nintendo game I've ever seen in my puff with people smoking in it.
Aye, everyone's
smoking. It's censors forgot to take it out. Hundreds of the NPCs are just like leaning on bars having a puff.
Everyone's puffing in it, aye, that's right.
You get folk in this town that's been beset by monsters are like, fuck's sake, like sparking a fag. Like, it's their only small pleasure in life.
So, for this reason, I'm bestowing upon it the special Golden Snout Award on behalf of Dynamite Neddy. Well done, Faxanadu. Faxanadu, as Andy was sort of saying in his intro spiel there, is, I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it off the bat. It is a better version of Axe Battler. It's an action RPG that executes that kind of idea a lot better. The whole game is played as a sort of side-scrolling platformer where you attack with a weapon, mostly a sword, but you get magic spells as well. It's got that kind of Wonder Boy and Monsterland thing where there's not really any lines of demarcation between the toons and the dungeons. Your sprite doesn't change or anything like that, or the way you move about doesn't change or anything. It's an action game with RPG elements, I suppose. It was kind of answering a lot of things that I said that I didn't like about Axe Battler, and that I would have preferred maybe different equipment types, or experience system, for instance. It's got all that in it.
A lot of emphasis on buying shit.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, I should probably say, the origins of this one actually goes back to the fucking microcomputers. But know your fucking C64 and your Spectrum. It's the fucking Japanese microcomputers had this series on it called Dragon Slayer. And then the sequel to that was called Xanadu. Hence why this is Fa Xanadu, because it was Xanadu on a Famicom. And then fucking Nintendo after that. And a lot of these old fucking Japanese role-playing games, a way to pad out the length a wee bit would be you probably couldn't get by this next dungeon unless you bought a better sword, and to buy a better sword, you had to panel like 50 monsters till you had enough gold to buy it, and then you got on to the next bit.
Grinding.
Which is fine, that's just how they used to fucking do it back in the day. My favourite thing about this game, and probably why I imagine it would appeal to the likes of your man Johnny Greenwood, other than the fact people smoke it, that is my top favourite thing in it, it's the presentation of it. Everything, it's dark fantasy. Everything's quite dark, gloomy, oppressive. The townspeople are all quite fucking downtrodden and oppressed. The game definitely gets brownie points for a bit of show, don't tell, in its story. Because off the bat, you have your adventurer, the main character, and he's coming back to his toon after being on a long journey. And the game just flings you in. Your toon's fucked, it's been destroyed, everybody's miserable, and you just sort of walk about in this kind of weird, sad atmosphere. The plot of it is, it's kind of a race war.
You've been away fighting dragons or something, haven't you? You come back, you're fucking just pure, your arse has fell out of your gaff.
I think it's unclear what your man has been up to. I don't know if that ties into Dragon Slayer and Xanadu. Maybe he was away fighting, maybe he's the character in the games as well. I've not played them, but the world that this is set in anyway has got elves and it's got dwarves. And they used to live in sort of peace and harmony. The elves lived at the base of this thing called the Tree of Life, and the dwarves lived next to it up on a mountain. But a meteor fucking drops, and all the dwarves start turning into these weird fucking mutant things, killing the elves. So you get back for your journey, and then immediately your king sort of sends you away to sort it out, try and stop the dwarves from fucking killing you, and like poisoning a magic well or something. I can't really remember the specifics on that point. But yeah, the game achieved a bit of fucking melancholy for me there. The fucking toons you go through, as I say, everybody's sad. They've all got fucking 40 a day habits. and it's just all a wee bit gloomy. And in contrast to a lot of games on the old Nintendo, it's not very colourful. It's all quite dark. But sometimes when that's done, it looks shite. But it doesn't in this. It looks really good.
The only bit I played was like the very beginning, and everyone's a kind of horrible, muddy, red-brown colour. It just adds to this kind of miserable look to
it's got a bit of Monty Mo to it. What do you call that game I played with the egg? Eggy Boy, what's his name again?
Dizzy
the egg guy, he's got a bit of that, you know, where the colours, so it's like this full spectrum of colour across the screen, but everything on that section goes with that colour in a weird way.
Andy, go into the tune a wee bit for me. What Radiohead tune samples and what tune is it for Facinado that it does sample? Because as I was playing, full disclosure, I'm not very good at this. I didn't get past the second boss. The second kind of area was like a mist world, and I couldn't get through it. But what tune and what song?
Well, my comment goes to the very end of a song on OK Computer, the album's called. Track 5 called Let Down. I think it is Let Down. Go to the very, very end there. Facinado actually plays out throughout the whole song. The song kind of dies out, and all you can hear is the Facinado tune in the background. But there's other examples too. I think they've done it like 4 times. But Facinado, one of the tunes plays like the whole time through a song in the background. It's just one of it.
I'll listen to it then. I'll try and find what song for the Facinado soundtrack is.
Aye, I wouldn't put the Radiohead song on because we'll just get copyright fucking struck or something like that.
Yeah, that to me sounds like maybe like the Johnny Greenwood had left it on pause in the studio and it just get picked up on the microphone by accident. If it plays through the whole song. Don't do that. I'm going to turn your favourite question around, Mick, because I had a bit of experience with this. How is the jump in this game?
Right, so for me, this is the letdown side of Facinado. I found the gameplay a wee bit frustrating. It's not that the jump itself is very bad. It's a bog standard jump for an NES game, right? You jump in a kind of arc. The problem being is that it has that platforming in it where it gives you just enough fucking room to make it. Mick, you were talking about this before, where they give you a wee bit of extra airtime in games, because in your head, you're like, I should have made that.
Yeah, aye, Coyote Time.
Coyote Time.
To Wile E. Coyote. Yeah, this is more of a modern, I think you mentioned, I'm not sure when it first came about, but in the NES era, that probably wasn't a thing. Like, if you've missed the pixel, you've fucking missed it almost all the time.
So in dungeons, I found this a couple of times where I would clear the enemies out the room, I would climb a ladder, try to jump across a pit, miss it, have to go up, climb a ladder again, try to jump across a pit, miss it, climb again. This might just be me being shite, but it feels as if you need to be quite fucking dead on with your jumps. What I would say is the jump is alright, the platforms are too far apart. The other thing that threw me a wee bit is that the enemies have got fucking weirdly erratic attack patterns. In the early bits of the game, if that's what you've played, there's a small sort of, it's got no arms, but it's bipedal. It's like a horrible wee ball that's just an eyeball with feet. and sometimes that jumps into you and jumps away. Sometimes it's more aggressive. I couldn't really work out what the rules for it were. So I found myself anticipating these things quite a lot, and then oftentimes just using up all my magic because I couldn't be fucked trying to sword fight them.
How is it the magic works in this? Because I think that my experience with the sword was that it's a bit shite. Like, is magic a kind of a projectile or?
Yes, exactly. Magic is like if you've played old Zelda, when you've got full health and a sword does that thing where it shoots out like a sword projectile.
Right.
Your first spell, I can't even fucking remember what it's called. It's called something weird in a shop. You wouldn't think to buy it. It was only after I'd tried everything else that I went back and got it, and I was like, oh, that's a spell. It uses a sort of sword projectile. So when you attack, if you hold the up button, well, you press B, and it fires this sort of fucking projectile spell out. You also get a spell that lets you float, but it only lasts for 30 seconds at a time. And you need that to get through certain dungeons where you can't really platform traditionally. That was the only spells I encountered.
Do you just kind of get like one of these things, or do you have to, can you buy and stock up on them, or do you only get like a limited number?
You have an MP bar. You've got magic points or magic power, and that'll run down the more you use your spells. there are also like key items you need to find, literally fucking keys as well. To get into the dungeons, you usually need to take a specific sort of key with you. At the first start of the game, it's all jack keys, as in cards. I think they're all like jack keys, queen keys, king keys and that. And you need that to get through certain doors. But you wouldn't necessarily think to buy a load of those in the first toon. I don't know, it's full of kind of, it's of its time, it's full of old kind of cryptic things like that.
That's an idea.
Well, Andy, you said you played this about 10 years ago. What do you remember for playing it?
I remember Shopkeepers. I remember a 2D kind of platformer, and as you said, a bit like Monster World, Alex Kidd. A wee bit harder. I remember just having to get money all the time to buy stuff. But I liked that. I smoked a lot of weed in that back in the day. I liked getting into like kidding when I was like getting into shops and that and just half of my fucking weirdo. But
we've all seen you streaming.
Aye. I thought it was a bit unconventional. And I thought like all the wee like different characters and that would be right up your street, because I know you like all that shit. That's kinda why I gave you it, man.
I like the setting and I like the fucking presentation of it a lot. I found playing through the dungeons a wee bit fucking frustrating. I was getting to a point in one of the missed dungeons where I was fucking save stating constantly and I was still getting my cunt kicked in and I was getting fucking raging with it and I was just like, nah, it's I'm not as big a Radiohead fan as you. I don't want to see the end of that bad.
Do you know what I said? I said it was a... Wonder Boy.
Here. I like Frankenstein.
that's a good stoic name right there.
Travelta. I suppose it is a bit Wonder Boy in Monster Land, isn't it? It's a 2D scrolling RPG platformer.
Aye, again, a bit like Zelda 2 or Axe Battler for last time. I think there was maybe an idea that this was maybe the kind of fucking way forward for role-playing games, and that they should be more like this. People want a more kinetic experience, you know, where rather than hit and attack, you want the feel of fucking swinging a sword yourself.
Yes, you do.
I mean, in that respect, you could argue that these games were possibly forward-thinking, because now that's what it's all about.
Dark Souls.
Well, the Souls series, and Final Fantasy VII has been remade this way. Knights of the Old Republic is looking like it's going to be a lot more, run in and you get to wave a lightsaber about yourself rather than just...
setting up your attacks.
Aye, real-time with pause combat type things.
You could come at it from two directions. It could either be, we want to make a platformer, but it has a bit more depth to it in terms of RPG mechanics, or we want to make an RPG that's a bit more immediate. Does this feel like they wanted to make a platformer first or an RPG first?
RPG first. I think. Especially given the roots of the series, you've got to remember that I think Dragon Slayer might even... I don't know if it predates Dragon Quest, but it might. So nobody quite knew how to make the likes of something like Wizardry or Ultima, but make it a console.
Has it got a bit of fucking River City Ransom about it? In the sense that the formula is like, got to go and buy shit for the next bit to get by that bit. Once you get by that bit, you're at the next toon, then the next mole, and then you've got to buy the next power-up to get through the next dungeon. Winged boots or a bigger sword or something, whatever.
No, it doesn't feel like a sandbox to me. River City Ransom felt like a really fucking old-school attempt at an open-world sandbox-type game. Faxanadu might try to lead you to believe that it's no linear, but it is quite linear. You play it in a straight line to an extent.
We've played a couple of these in a row, really. Like you've Dax Battler, you've this one. It seems like we're maybe like could be circling towards a good example of a game in this genre.
Don't get me wrong, this is a good example. This is a lot better than Axe Battler. I think it's possibly me being shite at this one, rather than the game being a particularly fucking bad attempt at it. Particularly since this is considered a fucking hidden gem by quite a lot of people. If you look up like top 10 hidden gem lists on the NES and that, this fucking virtually always features on them.
It was always in your retro gamer. What do you call it? Retro gamer's name again? Darren or something, the editor guy. One of his favourite games. But see, I get what you're saying, man. See, this type of format, a game, I suppose there is better ones out there. I mean, case in point, what we were talking about, the Wonder Boy games, especially 4 onwards, they're like this, but they're so much better. And just a little better to look at as well, you know. Maybe I should just give you Wonder Boy.
No, please, no. I don't want to play 3 games in a row so similar. give me a fucking Mahjong game or something next. I don't know, fucking left field. Look, this is better than Axe Battler. I mean, pretty much every bone I had to pick with Axe Battler, this game fixes. It's just old school hard, which maybe I couldn't be fucked with this time round. If it had caught me during a different sort of wee playing session, I might have got really deep into this and finished it, but this time around it didn't. I would say it's worth a look, especially for its kind of creepypasta vibes, and because it's, you know, it's so highly rated. But for me, the gameplay is a wee bit creaky, and it shows its age in some ways.
Aye, that's fair comment, man. That's fair comment, because facts and I do, but I'm afraid on this occasion it's facts and I don't.
No, I think... I think Faxana, I'll give you it.
Faxana, maybe.
I don't really have much else to say about it. I appreciated it, but I was never going to finish it, I don't think.
Aye. No, that's fair dues, man. That's fair dues. Right, we'll make sure we keep you off the old fucking side-scrolling RPG 2D platform, come fucking RPG element games in, right, for a while.
Simon's Quest or that...
Nah,
no, please, Nate. Again, this is a better game of Simon's Quest as well. Fucking Nate, overly cryptic nonsense, like having to crouch for 20 seconds at the side of a level to turn into a tornado and shite like that.
What, is that really a hangout? That fucking sounds terrible, man.
Andy, I thought with you being a fucking angry video game nerd fan, you would know all about that. He did a whole big video fucking ripping into Simon's Quest.
This is why you've got to get into the door for the start, and they couldn't get into the door. You've got to jump over like some sort of portcullis or something.
Don't know. I just remember him saying, "This game's dog shit. How come you gotta turn into a tornado?"
And shit, oh, that's fuck. Rank.
Right. Simon's Quest is where all the From Software games got all their best patter for, like fucking hidden was obtuse nonsense. Like that's the progenitor of all that.
Aye, I remember not to play that.
Well, bringing us back to our Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ, we are going for a game with a heavy Christian imagery that was maybe sort of trimmed away a wee bit in localization. McCormick, why did you pick ActRaiser for Mr. Andy MacArthur?
So this was one that I discovered. I kind of mean, if it was you that introduced it to me, but I definitely remember playing it in our old flat on the Wii Virtual Console. And it kind of just...
No, it was on... I fucking had it, man. You would have played it on hardware, right?
Oh, aye. So you had the actual SNES ROM. I saw you did. This one just kind of struck me as it was something that was kind of really unique at the time. Kind of... combination of like side scrolling, beat 'em up with God Sim, with like a wee kind of sprinkling of RPG elements in that as well. I think Enix were kind of had doing a lot of kind of interesting things in the SNES that maybe didn't get the appreciation that they should have. But I just thought Andy might enjoy it. I know he likes his side scrolling beat 'em ups, but using that as a kind of avenue into more unusual aspects, like the kind of the town building stuff like that as well. I thought it might be something he might quite enjoy. So I heard you go on with it.
ActRaiser's cool, man. It's when I first turned it on, right, I knew, you obviously told me a wee bit about it, it's got some strategy stuff and that in it, but when I turned it on, I was greeted with what I thought was a very well done kind of Castlevania ghouls and ghosts thing.
See, that's how it gets you. That's how it gets you at the start. You go into this kind of 2D world, you're a big buff guy with a sword. There's that pure thumping, like Castlevania style music plays the very first in the very first level as well. And you can be fooled for thinking that that's what the whole game is going to be about.
And it really is. I mean, even the level looks like something like a Castlevania or Ghosts and Ghosts. But
can I just say as well, speaking of fucking thumping tunes, I don't know if either of you know this, but the composer of this one, once again, Mr. fucking Streets of Rage himself, Yuzo Koshiro.
Big Yuzo, man. He's a fucking legend, Tim, man. But,
I knew that. I'm always going to rate his games highly, man. He's a personal hero of mine.
I knew that we weren't just dealing with like, a fucking stupid design game here when the angry trees turn up, right? The first level, there's this bit where to get past, you've got to jump on an angry tree. And just the design put into this angry tree's face just shows you that there's a lot of thought and care going into like the sprites and the characters in this game. Aye, that's something that carried through towards the end of this level. But then the level ends, right? And you're cast into, I guess, what is it, Mode 7 Heaven? Something.
Describe it, yeah.
You're turned into a wee cherub, who, by the way, the lore of which is sort of the cherub installed himself into the heart of that warrior that you are. Is that right, Sir Alex?
It's a statue that kind of divine light flies into at the start of the levels, it seems to be. Then the statue comes to life.
So that's your kind of character on the side-scrolling sections. It's like a kind of, yeah, this divine inspiration turns the statue into a warrior. But like the cherub, is that like your wee... The cherub you play in the Godsim bits, is that like your wee advisor? Does he work for you?
See, the cherub, I thought the cherub was possessing the fucking Sir Alex.
So in the fucking Japanese version of this, the fucking original, it's a lot less fucking cryptic. It's more straightforward that you are God and that you're trying to beat Satan at the end, that the main baddie is a devil. In this, you put your name in, so rather than being Judeo-Christian God, you are a God, rather. So I think you're controlling the statue, and I think to an extent you're controlling the cherub as well, but the cherub does also advise you when you're in your sky palace.
We are kind of pondering this mystery, but in Catholic dogma, that will be described as the mystery of the Trinity, right? So you've got the player, who is like the father.
You've got a cherub, a statue, and the Holy Spirit.
The cherub is the Holy Spirit, that's God's will upon the world, and then the son would be your kind of your warrior side scroller. That's God kind of down in physical form on the earth.
Exactly, no Gnostic shit here.
So the thing that got me right away was, I got this notion that I quite like to sail the ocean, and I just couldn't do it because I never had any wind. I felt like I was playing black and white again, but be a twist. There's a wee bit when you're building this game whereby it turns into like a fucking kind of 8-direction shooter or a 4-direction shooter.
It plays like a Defender or
Defender,
something. Well,
that's what I was thinking.
While you're building your buildings, like bats and dragons and that fly at you, and you need to hit them with wee arrows to keep them out your road.
So you've got hostiles that can attack your wee town, your wee build. It's a wee SimCity build.
The narrative of this is like you've you're going down, you're destroying all the monsters in this kind of one region of the world, and then once you've destroyed the monsters, a couple of humans are like, thanks, we can start building, we can like rebuild civilization here. And then that goes into this God Sim section where, as well as like playing this defender thing where you're defeating wee monsters that are trying to attack the townspeople, you're also guiding the townspeople to build houses and buildings on the wee areas of the map. And you direct them towards like...
Aye, the next turn.
Well, you direct them towards like the spawn points of the monsters.
Aye, the monster layers they're called. Yeah, and they can build over them.
They'll seal them up, but while they're still there, you've got to literally shoot them and kind of get rid of them. And then... Aye. When you've done enough of them, there's another dungeon at the end of that toon where you kind of finish off the monsters in that region for once and for all.
Effectively, you have, I don't know, maybe six monster lairs, and when you've sealed them all, the townspeople will again come to you with another problem.
Aye.
And it's different for town to town. Like, I think one of them's a monster that's like stealing Wayne's dreams or something. another one, it's like a minotaur that's been menacing people, and they'll say, God, come on, come down and finish this last fucking thing, and then we can live in peace.
I think it's mental how they got to cast a sensible soccer to play a townspeople in this game.
I loved watching them just going about doing their business. Aye. There's a bit where, like, as well as kind of building things, the townspeople occasionally give you gifts, and those gifts are usually, like, magic scrolls, which means that you're... character in the fighting bits can cast a new magic spell. There's a kind of quite basic sort of graphics building your toon, but there's a bit where they go, oh, there's a magic scroll on that island, we're going to go and check it out. And you can see like one of these wee tiny sensible sort of guys like leaving the temple, walking over the path that you've created to the edge of the water, gets on a boat, gets the boat over the island, he cuts about looking for this thing, gets back on the boat again. Like just wee levels that wee level of detail, quite like just watching your wee dudes going about doing their stuff.
So the side scrolling bits are obviously fucking good. They're well executed, thumping soundtrack, blah blah blah, but this is a top 10 SNES game for me. It's been like a long favourite, and it is mostly because of the weird defender building the toon sections. Like, I find myself being unable to fucking stop playing the bits. They are so fucking addictive.
So it's disjointed. It's a bit like you get that much into the God Sim, but you forget that there's all shit today, man. And like, I'm a big fan of side-scrolling like, arcade shooters and beat-em-ups and that. It's mainly a shooter, to be honest. Mainly a kind of ghouls and ghosts kind of thing. But I like game bits. Like, there was bits that was kind of like Metroid. See, like, a bit of bits when you've got to jump up vertical? It's like vertical paths and all that. I like all that shit, man, right?
It's... Yeah, North Wall, it's called, that snow bit. You've got to climb a big tree at the end.
And, you've got to avoid enemies. You've got to judge how high enemies are other than that, and to use your projectile or your sword, whatever it is. I like all that shit, man. And I liked how the enemies moved as well. Like, there was no fucking about. You could time enemies' move. You could, like... plan your hit, and you really felt the crunch and other thing I like in games as well. Everything was fair. There was a real fairness to this game. Like Metroid and like Castlevania, there was like no cheap shots.
You've not got hundreds of moves. You've just can kind of walk around, jump, use your sword, cast a couple of spells that you maybe only do once or twice. Or if you're like me and Mick, you get that flaming shower spell, and you save all those up, and then you just rinse every single boss in the game with it.
Oh, the stars that fall down. Aye, that's a game breaker.
This game's quite a lenient field of attack as well. Like, when you're ducking, you can actually get a good bit of them by just doing the ducking hit. Some games don't allow you to have a very effective ducking hit, but this game does.
He's got a good big jump and a good big hitbox on his sword.
The hitbox is good. You get a satisfying big slash, don't you?
You do, man. And you can attack your enemy at various... kind of lengths, so you attack them like right in the middle of them, or you can attack them like a wee bit out for them and stuff like that, and it still feels as good. I like the side-scrolling bits of this game. I'm going to be controversial here, right, you know me. I'm not much of a fucking strategy game guy, right? I thought that this game really excelled in its design and its 2D sections. And I know that's not going to be popular, but
no,
it's a really, really good fucking 2D kind of side-scrolling platformer, I suppose, in a way.
What is it you would call that? Like a side-scrolling slasher or something like that?
It's like fucking Castlevania meets Ghouls and Ghosts meets a bit of... That's it.
This was controversial because a sequel to ActRaiser did come out and they got rid of the fucking Angel Toon building bits entirely. And it was just the big buff guy doing side-scrolling levels.
Right, okay. Okay, how did you feel about that? Didn't I like that, did you?
I think what makes this game unique is the fact that it's got both. And I think if I was making a sequel to it, I would have, you know, expanded a bit more on the, even the town building stuff and that. Maybe have that kind of feed more into the side-scrolling. But I think it was a bit of a missed opportunity because there's plenty of other games that are like 2D side-scrolls, you know what I mean? This one stands out for the crowd because it's got both.
Aye, you could have played with it a wee bit more. I don't know if I would have gone down the route of maybe putting slightly more RPG into it, but being that, like how in this you can only get magic scrolls by doing the town building bits, that an incentive to build up your toons more would be to have a more powerful character and fleshed out side-scrolling bits. Something like that, maybe.
Yeah, so the way the side-scrolling bits and the top-down bits are kind of linked together, this is where the kind of RPG stuff comes in a wee bit. So when you're building your town, as there's more houses, it kind of leads to there being like more population in the town. And then the higher the population they get, the higher your level is, and that gives you like more HP in the side-scrolling bits. So you're encouraged to like build up your towns, and it's kind of non-linear as well, so you don't need to like do one 2D bit of town, the other 2D bit, you can like go to the map at any time and go around and build up the other towns. So if you're struggling at one of the platforming bits, you can finish some more towns and then go back to a platform bit that you're struggling at with more health, and then that kind of like that might kind of let you get a wee bit further in it. And there's other kind of like mad stuff as well, where like sometimes you'll be going through one of the town building sections and the townspeople will be like, it's freezing here, we can't progress any further, like, do you have anything that could help us? And then you go to another town and it's like, oh yeah, we invented woolly jumpers. You can take that technology from one town to the next.
Aye.
But what I kind of thought, like, if you know, talking about like how you could have expanded on it in a sequel is that, like, the town stuff, you're pretty much just filling the map with houses. Like, you don't get to have much choice over, you know, what your town is like.
It's,
I would have
maybe,
yeah, it's you don't have to think too much. It's definitely addictive, but you're not really making any like choices. Like, my idea was that maybe you could have a bit of a choice, almost like a wee bit like black and white of like, what sort of god am I? Like, say you're building this town and you're like, well, I want to build something that's like Sparta, that's a pure warrior town. Everyone's, there's military academies, everyone's pure buff as fuck, and maybe that makes you more like more of a fighting god in the 2D bits, like you get more HP, you fight me a sword and that. But or you could make it like in Athens, a pure centre of learning and religion, and then that would maybe give you better magic, stuff like that. Maybe you're making some choices. And also, maybe do you want to be a good god or a bad god? Like, how do you want to fucking treat these people like complete pawns, or do you want to like be nice to them as well?
like that black and white game. Where you could be like good or evil, man. That was the whole point of it, wasn't it? It was like, are you a benign god or are you a fucking arsehole god, man?
But there was one part of this game where I was an evil god by complete accident. You got some spells in this game that you can cast during the town building sections. One of them is an earthquake, and it says that on certain maps something special will happen if you cast this spell. So I got it wrong. I thought you were to cast it in one place, but you actually weren't. But I cast it, and then I scrolled down a wee bit, and all the toons' houses were destroyed. Like the whole map, just all the houses were flattened. I was like, oh fuck, that was me. All the townspeople had to like rebuild their toon just because I made an arse of it.
Mick, I got a bit of Sonic Adventure 2-ification after this game. What I mean by that is,
interesting.
Oh, I can't wait till good bits come back on. But
oh no.
Oh, you found yourself bored during the Angel bits, really?
I was the opposite.
Do you know what? I like both. I like the side-scrolling bits, don't get me wrong, but I was the opposite as well. I was always looking more forward to being able to build up the next town.
I can see why, because I like all the kind of, I can understand why, right? But I see even in the town bits, the bits I enjoyed was shooting the invaders. Pew, 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 got away from my town.
The actual development in the town, there's not much to it. It's just like, go here, seal this thing, seal the next one. Like, as I was saying, you're not given a whole lot of choice, but it's just like the numbers going up, Ping. You know, it's if you play RPGs, you like seeing the numbers go up. Aye. Seeing your fucking tune increasing, that makes you stronger and that gets your hooks on you.
I think that's maybe where we differ in preference, man, because I've been one for watching the numbers go up. I mean, unless I'm playing Champ Manager and it's my score, or it's ring counter or something. You know, my head's built to like, right, all right, where can I fuck cunts up with a sword? you know, I don't know, man, my brain works that way. And perhaps, I think the levels were so well designed in this game, I kind of look forward to seeing the next 2D stage.
Aye, that's true. And those bits are good. There's
You always look forward to seeing what the next boss looked like as well.
Aye, exactly. Because, as I said, the detail, especially in the first boss, the kind of minotaur guy, you can tell right away that, sorry, the characters are what really Kerr's been taking with them. As you go on, like, I'm going to be honest, I didn't complete the game because I found the world building bits just a bit too, what's the word, quite upset, cattle ranch here, a bit too, I want to get back to the 2D bits again.
I ended up finding myself almost completing it. I'd never done so before, but I got to the bit that Mick was saying he struggled with, which is that at the very end, there's this a kind of boss rush section. I had made the mistake of, well, it seemed like the right idea at the time, doing that kind of exploit to make the bosses really easy with magic, but then if you have to fight them all at the same time, you quickly run out of magic, and you have to actually fight them with your sword, at which point I was like, oh, shit, I've not practiced for this.
A few bosses where the pattern is really fucking easy. There's one that's just like a block that like falls down and you run over and attack it, and then, do you know like the egg robot at the end of fucking Sonic 2? There's a boss that's like that. There's a few bosses that have got a really easy pattern, but there's a couple you can kill really easy with that fucking magic, so you never learn the pattern. So it's like, if you want to save your magic, if you want to save your magic, it's like having to work out how to fight them for the first time and save a wee bit of fucking health.
I see this game from like a technical standpoint. Well, it's fucking impressive that it came on a cartridge, isn't it? I mean, like, look at the parallax growing in this game. It's better than you could see, let's say, perhaps on a Mega Drive. It's so well done. Great. So fluid.
Early SNES as well, man.
Aye. And then it jumps to Mode 7, which, I mean, at the time, when seeing zooming in on things like that and like changing like the scaling of an object and all that stuff, I mean, cunts must have been pure blown away with this game at the time.
Aye. And you can, like, when you see your toons built up, like, as you zoom out into the kind of big world map, you can see all the stuff you've done to the wee toons, like, for a distance on the world map. So it starts as a pure barren world map, and then it ends up pure built up with, like, towns and roads and all that. And that's kind of, like, based on what you've been doing in the game.
Aye.
Which I found quite cool.
It's got that. Do you know what? I've just realised that I think I've talked about it with a couple of different games we've played. If there's anything where you've got to uncover a map in a game, you know, where you've got like fog of war or whatever, I'm the type of player that will walk round all the corners so and fill in a map nicely. And I think building up a toon, because I'll not go to the next level until I have built the toon, and I can't build any more houses. I have covered every square inch in house.
Urban sprawl.
I've got to do it. I think it fucking scratches that itch quite nicely.
I liked how all the toons have got their own different kind of personalities and stuff like that. They're all kind of based off different societies. There's like one where it's like a kind of Japanese one where you face off kind of Japanese mythological warriors, and it's like based in a volcano. There's earthquakes happening all the time. There's like an Egyptian sort of desert one. There's a jungle one and stuff like that. You can see that in both sides of the game, like the monsters you fight in the 2D sections, but also the kind of town buildings. The towns look a wee bit different. The buildings look different and that. I thought that was quite cool.
What ActRaiser toon would you be for?
I would be for Bloodpool, because that's just a good name. It's a good name for Glasgow, isn't it?
We'll be all thinking Bloodpool, I take it then, because it was also maybe my answer.
It sounds like something Bart Simpson would like.
You're not going to pick fucking Fillmore, are you? Or Eitos, I think, is a Japanese one.
The thing I like about Bloodpool was that you defeat the demon that was causing the lake to be cursed and become blood red. It turns still called Bloodpool. It's like, we all just get used to the name. We didn't have the heart to change it.
Is Bloodpool not what they call Blackpool when you venture too far away from the beach?
Well, Liverpool on a sunny day when there's been a couple of rival gangs there.
And also Dublin. No, the etymology of Dublin is, do you know what a ski and do? In a kilt where you've got a knife in your sock, it's called a ski and do, which is literally like black or dark knife. So do wind, or I don't know if in Irish it's more dub wind, means black pool, aka fucking. So Dublin is Irish for Blackpool.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's fucking true, by the way. Fact check me if you want.
Verging slightly in a little hot take territory here. Mick described this as maybe being quite a Christian game with some Christian themes. The part to me that is most Christian is that you are sort of colonising these places that we considered maybe to be uncultured or uncivilised, but making them kind of Christian by getting rid of like what seems to be sort of pre-Christian deities. Like, if you think about most of the monsters you fight in this, it's like you go to like the North Wall, kind of, which is like the kind of Norse sort of region. You kill all these fucking like North mythological beings.
They're natives.
Yep, you go to Egypt and like you kill fucking things that look like Osiris and all that. So you're getting rid of the pagan gods. You're installing monotheism. You're installing kind of modern civilization along with it.
Interestingly, what comes next after that is that people become less interested in religion as the world gets more and more built up. And the ending of ActRaiser involves the wee cherub saying, you know, you're basically there slapping your hands, rubbing them together like that. Right, who's praying? And they go, nobody's praying. You've done everything.
They don't need you anymore.
They don't pray anymore. And then you just fuck off.
And the thing as well is like there's a bit of like the kind of manifest destiny to this. Like, see when you go to the desert town, folk are like, right, well, there's too much sand here. Like, we can't build the town. There's fucking hundreds of sand. Like, can you cast some spells and maybe like, you know, sweep this sand away and that? And it's like, what? That'd be a huge ecological disaster. Like, what? Well, I think all the fucking like life, plants and animals that have lived there for hundreds of years. But then all of a sudden these new settlers come on. It's like, nah, fuck this. We are going to like kind of terraform this place. People have been living there, like, you know, living off the land. You know, Bedouins, nomads, probably thousands of years. And then your guys come along. It's like, no, I don't like sand. Get rid of it.
Oh, we've got a prayer from the Duke of Sutherland. Oh, can you make it so that these Highland areas could be more conducive to sheep?
That's why you've got to stick them in a wigan, man, before they bring his army back with a minute.
Exactly.
That's what the baddies in this game are. Same with the snowy bit. It's like, oh, it's too cold. Can you melt all this snow? It's like, just build fucking igloos. Live off the land.
But this game here, do you know what? See that kind of sentiment I seen numbers going up. Do you think they got rid of it in the second one because of the fickle, like, kind of US and European audience of kind of brain dead boys like myself that just like action, action, action?
I'm going to take a punt on this. I'm pulling this explanation out my arse, right? I'm guessing that this was maybe difficult to develop. You know, simultaneously making two games, really, and wedging them together. So, for a sequel to a hit game, quick turnaround, make a few bucks, they had to really just pick maybe one of the things and stick with it, rather than going for both of them again. And it would make more sense to make a whole game out of the side-scrolling bit, rather than out the angel bit.
Aye. That makes sense.
As a guess, by the way, I don't know if that's what happened.
No, it does make sense, but I mean, it's one of them kind of occasions where, I mean, in games, I mean, usually the second game's better than the first one, isn't it? I suppose that you guys would say that the first game's kind of an outlier better because it has this kind of kind of other half to it, in a way.
It's a top 10 SNES game for me, as I said. I love this one.
I can imagine. Do you know what? I'm not going to sit here. It's one of them ones. The game is obviously fucking amazing. I just enjoyed the 2D sections a lot more than the other ones. But I can appreciate both. and I appreciate how much they put onto a stupid wee cart.
Give the fucking sequel a bash, because I'd be interested to know if you'd really like that one. Because as I said, I didn't like it as much, but if it's more about you liked for the first one, you might like it better.
I'm sure I would, man. I'm sure it'd be good. Get it on there, man, maybe through the line.
Aye, maybe.
Yes. Aye, I suppose I've said my piece on it. Thank you very much.
Anything to add, Mick?
No, I'd probably put it in the same camp for me, to be honest. I think it's top 10 SNES for me. Really enjoyed replaying it again. Depends on the type of gamer you are. I think we've figured out that there's different ways to different types of people's hearts. So maybe this one will find its way into yours, or maybe not.
Aye, right, well, that will bring us nicely on to next time and our picks and what we've got for each other. Well, listener, it's been a wee while since we've had a guestie. Next time, we are going to have on friend of the podcast and regular listener.
Fellow podcaster.
A fellow podcaster as well.
Nick Dunning of Just One Cornetto podcast, by the way.
Fellow podcaster from the Morton Supporters podcast. Aye, Craig Dunning is going to be on, and I will, on his behalf, dish out his game first of all. And it's one for Mr. Andy Mack. Andy, it is a Sega Mega Drive game with a soundtrack by Michael Jackson.
Sonic 3.
It is, of course, Michael Jackson's Moonwalker. That's what you'll be playing next time on.
He'll bait and switch.
I think fucking... Have we done Moonwalker on this before?
No. But it's... Do you know, we've never even talked about it before, but it's the type of thing that was in a lot of wee piles back in the day, man.
I'm fucking surprised we've not done Moonwalker, man.
Well, we're getting it on next
Let's
time.
Do it. Who's bad, man?
Oh, we know who's bad.
There's going to be all I suppose, aye. For fuck's sake, there's not much worse, is there?
Well, Mick, what have you got for Mr. Dunning?
Right, so I've all played Streets of Rage. Everyone loves it. Streets of Rage 2, expanded on it, even better. Not so many people talk about Streets of Rage 3, which is the one I'm going to be giving out.
Off.
Probably the most controversial entry in the series, but might generate some lively debate. Dunning is fortunate enough to have an original Mega Drive, the original hardware that he can play this one on, so I thought a Mega Drive game that's going to spark a bit of debate seems ideal.
I'd be willing to bet that a good fucking, maybe majority of people that listen to this podcast have never even played Streets of Rage 3. I would wager that.
I played it,
maybe.
And it was, I'll maybe tell a story next time if I remember, but a classmate of ours whose mum worked abroad, he had it before it was fucking out in Europe. And I remember playing at Asus. Andy, what have you got for me?
So, I thought I'd give you a wee break for these fucking taxing 2D epics and give you a kind of 2D non-epic. I'm going to give you a nice wee light platformer for the Game Boy Advance that I used to play having many a shite back in 2002-2003. It's Crash XS for the Game Boy Advance. A nice wee 2D Crash Bandicoot platformer.
Magic. Well, do you know, I don't think the Bandicoot has had a run out on Ned either, and I've got to admit I'm a bit of a fan, particularly of the first game, so I'll look forward to that.
Nice one.
And for Mr. McCormick, I am going for Loaded, which anybody who had the all PlayStation demo discs might remember. It's basically like a very dark science fiction version of Gauntlet, where you play as all these horrible anti-hero criminals. The artwork was done by all these guys for 2000 AD and that.
Cool.
To be honest, I don't know how well it holds up. I'm going back to our roots here and just picking stuff for childhood that I've no revisited, so we'll see how we got on with it, I guess.
I remember the adverts for this being like plastered over gaming magazines. Always thought it looked pretty cool, but never got around to playing it. So
the fucking clown pointing a gun at you.
I mean, that was like 90% of PS1 era games adverts, but yeah, this one does stick out. So yeah, looking forward to actually seeing what it was actually like after all these years.
So, shall we sign off in style?
I will sign off in
well,
style.
I'll tell you what, since we've Dunning coming on for the Just One Cornetto podcast, how about we make it Morton themed? How about we pump Jan Moore, Ali McGraw?